Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jeffersonville, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome to the 221st episode of Weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 230 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com, and John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. That's www.johnmack13.com, and they're under the radio show tab. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online weekly newspaper at my web home. The newspaper is a curation of news articles from around the country and the world, articles relating to politics, sports, books, the environment, arts, entertainment, opinion, and technology. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per week, and it's free. As those who have been listening to the show recently know, I am the freshly minted first poet laureate for the town of Yorktown. One of my acts in this capacity is the introduction of a monthly poetry workshop to be held at the John C. Hart Library in Shrub Oak, New York. The workshop will be the place for poets and would-be poets to sharpen their skills by reading their work, having it respectfully criticized, to listen to the work of others, and sharing information relating to the business of poetry. Publishing platforms, magazines, journals, and online, and reading opportunities, and resources, books, courses, and technology tools. It will meet monthly on the fourth Wednesday of each month, but the first meeting at 6 p.m. on this coming Wednesday, January 24th. If you plan to attend, please email me at johnmack13@gmail.com and plan on bringing 20 copies of the poem which you will read. I hope you'll join us every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings live, or as most to listen to later. Recordings are archived, as I mentioned, at the website. And notifications of the most recent shows are sent out weekly by email and on Facebook. Next week, my guest will be Yorktown poet Terry Dugan on the show. So I hope all listeners will, as they said, keep it right here. And to this show, the 221st in the series, as I mentioned, callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally hold the on-air participation of callers to near the conclusion of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is the recently elected and inaugurated town supervisor of Yorktown, New York, Elam D. Gilbert. Elam, or Lanny, as he is known, is an attorney and past Yorktown town judge. Good evening, Lanny. Congratulations on your recent victory, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. Good evening to you. And do you prefer John or John Mack?
John's fine. John.
Okay,
that's my
John.
Given name. John Mack's the nom de plume, as they say.
Okay.
So where did you grow up and go to early school?
Well, I grew up in Queens, although my parents and family were from the city. But then my dad had a farm up in Wappingers Falls years ago. And then right around when I was born, the family, due to circumstances, moved back to the city. And I started school in the public schools in New York, PS 173.
Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were?
When I was in public school or years ago, my earliest aspirations were probably to be a cowboy. I remember playing cowboys when I was very young, acting out as if I were riding a horse and things like that. And then actually when I did grow older, when I was in my early teens, I went to a riding camp, a place in Ulster County called Rawhide Ranch. So I actually fulfilled a little bit of those dreams early.
And then where'd you go to high school?
I went to Jamaica High School, still in Queens. Grew up right off of in Fresh Meadows, Flushing, Jamaica border. They all merged at the same area, off of Union Turnpike and Utopia Parkway. And
go ahead.
Yeah, that's fine.
And as you started moving toward college, did you have any clear guidelines of what you wanted to do with your life, what your aspirations were then?
Well, I grew up, that was a sort of a turbulent era. I was, I graduated high school in 74, so we were still involved in the Vietnam War. And just entering college, I was at least politically aware. I had two older sisters. Unfortunately, I lost my oldest sister back in 1989. But both my sisters were also politically active. And my immediate older sister, Adina, to Binghamton, and then went to St. John's Law School. And I sort of had very similar interests. So she was sort of my mentor in terms of the direction, in terms of profession.
And so after she went to law school, started you thinking of it anyhow?
Yeah, she was in law school while I was an undergrad. I was a political science major, economic minor, and I originally started with my folks wanted me to be, were pushing me towards, I had always done well in science and math, so they sort of were pushing me towards pre-med, and I spent about 3 weeks as a pre-med student at Binghamton as well, and then I quickly changed my gears. I realized that was not the direction I wanted to go into.
I noted that you were an artist and a political cartoonist on the college newspaper. A few years ago, one of my guests on the show was M.G. Lord, who for a number of years was a political cartoonist at Newsday. I wonder whether you ever came across her work.
Yeah, well, no. Yes, I mean, I followed many, but again, at the time, it was probably the start of Doonesbury had just sort of emerged, and that was sort of my focal point. And it was I've tried to do a little bit of a combination of just humor and also political satire, and then also political humor. And some serious political commentary as well.
The nastiest political cartoon I remember was back around that time. It was by Herbert Block, who was called Herblock in Washington Post, and it showed Dick Nixon with a scruffy beard climbing up out of the sewer. And I hadn't thought of that until last week's cover in a New Yorker showed a big white background, then the black hole like a manhole, and yellow orange hair sticking up out of it. And I've said, my God, this is the same as it was 40 years ago. But
right.
Well, also and, that probably was some sort of commentary as to, or at least a reference to the Stephen King novel and movie, It, I think.
Yes.
Clown had orange hair. And
yes.
I believe so, which is a very scary thing, as I believe is the state of our country right now. It's unfortunate, but I'm really, that's again one of the reasons why I had begun my political career, as you know, as you had said, as the town judge, and I was sort of more concerned with just trying to focus on the judiciary and the local courts and just the judicial system, because I felt that was the best way to achieve justice and fairness at the level where you're not having to deal with a lot of the political pushback and partisanship. Unfortunately, I loved serving the town as the town judge, but that wasn't meant to be a long term. It was 5 years, but it wasn't to be for the long term. And I then decided to get involved because I was unhappy with the climate, the political climate in the town.
Have you kept up with your drawing?
Not as much as I would like to. Every once in a while, I'll sketch something just for the purpose of relaxation. But no, I'm not to the degree. Maybe once I finally retire and have time to kick back a little bit, but I haven't. No, regrettably, I mean it, you know, sincerely. I do regret not doing it, but I've passed at least some of my, that gene has passed on to some of my kids, and they do have some talent, and it's nice to see, and I've enjoyed watching them pursue sketching and painting.
There's a friend of mine who's a member of the MAYPAC Writers Group with me, and he's been a guest on the show, and he also goes to the Hudson Valley Writers Center, where I also read, you know, where he reads, and he sketches all of the people who are reading or in the room, and he hands out the sketches during the readings, and they're always favorably received. People always smile, and they thank him, you know, so...
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting hobby for him too. And then you
mm-hmm.
went back. Then you went to law school out in Long Island to Hofstra. And you mentioned this was after your sister had gone to law school. Had you planned to go into public service then, or were you interested in private practice? Or what were your plans?
I was interested in public service, although there was a part of me. I love sports. I love. I'm a big baseball fan, football fan, basketball fan, college basketball fan, and part of me, there was a desire or a thought when I was in law school. Let me step back just for a second, and this is the reason why I had this thought process. I have a very good, I have a cousin, a first cousin, who loved music. And he was, when he was in college, he was the individual that would book bands for the college, the rock bands and things like that. And he then went to law school, and ultimately he became an entertainment lawyer, and he became a manager and a lawyer, and he represents some of the bigger bands. For a while, he represents currently the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Jewel,
okay.
And a couple of other famous artists, and he had represented years and years ago, before he passed, obviously, was Bob Marley, and also John Ritter, the actor John Ritter. So, moving forward with me, I watching that sort of that model. He was a little older than I, I had thought, you know, maybe I'd go to law school, and I love sports so much, maybe I'd become an agent or a sport, you know, a sports attorney. And that was one idea that I had, you know, floating out there. But then ultimately, I got my first hire was the court system, and they had me at hello, as they said in the movie McGuire, which also dealt with a sports a lawyer. But it was basically, I was hooked. I love dealing with constitutional issues and with the criminal law issues, and that's really where I spent my my whole career.
My wife was growing up was a big Tex Ritter fan, the father of John.
Mm-hmm. The father, that's right.
And then the grandson has been on television too. He played a someone in the wheelchair on the on a show. I remember, you know.
He's actually uncanny resemblance to his dad and mannerisms, I believe.
Yes. The best basketball player I remember coming out of the Hofstra, well, there was one whose name escapes me after, but I remember the fellow named Bill Feben who played in the NBA. He came out of Hofstra years and years and years ago.
Even though I went to Hofstra Law and I went to Binghamton undergrad, I grew up a block and a half away from St. John's University. So I'm a huge St. John's. Well, it used to be the Redmen, but now they're more politically correct, and they're the Red Storm. But I'm a big St. John's fan in college basketball.
Years and years, I'm a little older than you, or a lot older than you. When I started following St. John's, they have just graduated some great Jewish basketball players to play in the NBA. The most notable was Maxi Jaslowski. But so they came out of St. John during the war. And then, of course, it was the Maguires after them. So
that's correct. I followed them in the Lou Carnesecca, more of the Lou Carnesecca age, or, you know, well, he was the coach right after McGuire.
Yeah, he came out of St. Anne's Academy on the east side of Manhattan. Then they moved to Archbishop Molloy, and then he was an assistant to Lapchick. So
That's right. One of my favorite quotes by Carnesecca was he had a young Italian short Italian point guard, and he was criticized for playing him because he was Italian, and Carnesecca very quickly said, I don't play him because he's Italian, I play him because I'm Italian.
he had a good sense of humor. I can tell you who the starting team of the 1927 New York Yankees, 1949, 1950 Indians. I'm a sport fan. Who are your favorite teams, as long as you're on it?
Well, I don't want to part of me doesn't want to say, because I don't want to alienate some of the people in the town of Yorktown, because I don't want to say. But no, I'll be honest. I'm a Met fan. I grew up in Queens, and I am a football Giant fan, and I am as I said, a St. John's fan. I'm a Knicks fan, and I'm a Ranger fan. Those are my teams. And part of it all was because my dad was a baseball Giant and football Giant fan. He grew up in Harlem, in the city, and right by the Polo Grounds. So that's how he, you know, he followed the baseball, the Giants. And what happened was, obviously, when the Giants and the Dodgers went out to California, he remained a National League fan. And then when we were living in Queens, and when the Mets came to Queens, he very naturally took on a rooting interest for the Mets. I was very young. But I then became a Mets fan, and So that's my excuse, and I stick with it. But I'm a loyal fan.
I've been very lucky in a whole lot of things, including my sports fan. But I have become, after years of choosing the Mets over the Yankees and whatever, I've become a New York fan, and it really annoys me when people call the sports shows and the Met fans hate the Yankee fans hate the Met fans.
Right.
But one of the artifacts
the Yankees incredibly, though, I have to say. I respect the franchise, and I respect the history. I really do. And there's another very quick, funny story where my kids found a picture of me on the stoop of my parents' house. And I was probably about 6 or 7 years old, and I was wearing a Yankee jacket. And they were, oh, you know, Dad, you always said you were a Met fan. How, you know, look what we found and everything. And I said, well, let's analyze this. Again, as a good defense attorney would, I said, what year was this picture taken? And we figured it out. The picture was taken in 1961. So I said, well, let me give you two facts. First, the Mets didn't exist in 1961. They didn't come into existence until 62. So really, I could have rested the defense at that point. But I also said, and again, respecting Yankee history, I said, think about it. This was 1961. This is the year that Maris and Mantle were fighting to break Ruth's record. And I said, who in New York wasn't a Yankee fan that year? So, and then I said the defense rests.
I've been extremely lucky, not only in my life and my career, but also in sports. I have in my bedroom part of the goalpost from the 1958 New York Giant Baltimore Colts overtime game.
Wow. That's the game, as they say, that's the great, at the time they said it was the greatest game ever played.
Right. And I was in the bleachers, and for the overtime, I jumped down onto the field and I went down to the sidelines. And today I would have been arrested, hit over the head with a club, done whatever.
Yeah.
And they just said, don't stand too close. And I was yelling at L.G. Dupre, you're going to drop the ball. And then when it ended, I was at that time, the goal point were wooden, and we're able to break off a big piece. It's about 6 feet tall, and I have it in my bedroom. I also was through no fault of my own, in Joan Payson's private club after the Mets won the World Series, because two games earlier, I had passes to the Diamond Club where I'd never been, and I walked down and see everyone going into this, and I was dressed coming from Wall Street. I was in the suit, and I just walked in, and the fellow at the bar next to me, they weren't serving it, so I went to the bar, and the fellow next to me said, do you have a light? And at that time, the smoking bars, and I said yes, and it was Gordon McRae, who was some of the National Anthem, and two down from him, of Joe DiMaggio talking to Earl Warren. And I said, this probably is not the Diamond Club. So I immediately switched from Bibb to Drimbuie, spent the rest of the night, and then came back two nights later when they won it all, or three nights later, with four of my friends. And Pearl Bailey was there, and Casey Stengel, and Weeb Eubank, and John Lindsay. You know, it was a terrific night. So I was also very lucky.
That's quite a story.
Yeah, and Barbara and I were in the Nassau Coliseum when the Nets won their first NBA championship. So I've been very lucky.
That
being
is
the right place.
That's wonderful.
That's right.
To speak of, I have to. My main claim to fame in terms of sports, great piece of history. I was there when Secretariat won the Triple Crown. So.
Oh, you were.
That was yes. That was
at Belmont.
I had my dad. Yes, my dad had been a racing fan most of his life, and he used to, as a matter of fact, instead of my first event was a trip to the track before it was my first ball game, which is unusual. But he didn't have a gambling problem. He just loved the horses, So, and I still, to this day, I enjoy going to the track. I think it's a beautiful sport. And, but I was there, the day that Secretariat won. And I then followed Secretariat up to Saratoga that summer, and bet against Secretariat and won my bet because, a horse named Onion beat Secretariat on a very sloppy, muddy track, because Onion was a mudder, and I chartered it out, and I won a few bucks.
And one of the first poems that I remember was Grantland Rice, the famous sports writer, writing about the jockey named Earl Sandy, saying, "Here comes Sandy, booting those horses home," or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, Secretary was the finest horse I've ever in my lifetime. I don't know whether it's at some point, but the most impressive horse I've ever seen.
Up until Secretary, the big debates were between Man of War in the 20s and Native Dancer in the 50s.
Right. So, that's right.
And then
Citation was the horse that won.
Oh yeah, Citation rather than Native Dancer. Sure, Citation. Triple Crown at 48, I think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And that was the first, then when Secretariat won it, that was the first time a horse had won. There had been that big a gap from 48 to 73, which
wow.
was a huge span.
Unfortunately, I'm allergic to horses, and I'm actually allergic to dog's hair, but I didn't realize until about 10 years ago that I can have the kind of dogs that are expensive to groom, the ones that don't shed. So it's still a Sucker Terrier runs my house. So back to your career. After graduating in the top 10% of your class, you went to work with a John P. Collins. And what were your duties there?
Yes, he was. I'll tell you, I have to. I don't want to toot his own horn or my own horn. He happened to have been, and he's still around. He's retired, but I believe he was, if not the finest, one of the finest judges in all of New York. The New York judiciary. He himself was a former district attorney under Hogan in Manhattan, and then he became a court attorney, sort of the profession that I had all those years, and then he went back and joined the district attorney's office under Morgenthau and was the head or chief of their rackets and fraud bureau. And he remained there until he got appointed to the criminal court in New York. And I believe he was appointed originally by Abe Beam. And then he continued on and then was elevated to Supreme Court. Now, not everyone knows this, but just about every Supreme Court judge in the state is entitled to a court attorney or they have different. They go by different names, either a law assistant, court attorney, court clerk. It's all equivalent to what would be a federal clerk in the federal system. And
okay.
So they're entitled to a lawyer who basically gives them legal advice, helps them write or helps draft decisions, and who basically is there. As they say in The Godfather, their consigliere, their counsel, and that's the position I was hired by Judge Collins in 1982 out of law school. I originally started actually in the criminal court in the law pool of attorneys and interviewed with him for when he went to Supreme Court, and then it was a marriage that lasted quite long. I worked with him for 28 years. And we tried some of the more notorious cases because of his skill. We tried some of the more famous cases in the Bronx during those years, the more difficult cases. They assigned him some of the the most famous of those in terms of difficulty and complexity was the Ray Donovan case. He was the first Secretary of Labor ever indicted
right.
while in office. And it was a 9-month trial with 6 months of pretrial hearings with federal wiretaps. It was a very, very complex case. We had 11 defendants. And the trial itself lasted for 9 months. The jury selection started Labor Day, right, the day after Labor Day, and ended Memorial Day weekend. And it was really high profile. We had, 90 pretrial motions on the case. It was just a very, very, very interesting and fascinating and difficult case. But I was basically at his side for that case, and then continued on. And I was with him, like I said, for 28 years. He, in the middle of his tenure, I guess the court system recognized his talents in other ways as well. And then they made him the administrator of the criminal division in the Bronx. So he was basically in charge of the operation of the entire criminal division of Supreme Court for about 15 years.
Wow.
At that point, my job went from simply dealing with legal matters into administrative matters. I became his liaison to the mayor's office, to the Department of Corrections, to the probation department. Anytime he needed assistance with, one of administration aspect of the city, dealing with the city, he would lean on me in terms of some guidance, or just he had so much knowledge. I just kept on learning from him all the time, quite frankly, too. He just was, like I said, he's my mentor. If you look at my demeanor when I run the town board meetings or when I sat as a judge, it was very much in his fashion and his in that way.
That's a wonderful tribute, Lonnie. A well-known judge lived within two blocks of my house, who I saw. He was well-known for the Panther trials when they put the security around his house. He was best known for the book that he did probably in the early 60s or the mid 60s with a sociologist named Sarah Harris. It was about prostitution in New York. Judge John M. Murtaugh.
I know, absolutely one of the finer judges in the city as well.
Now his son was a councilman in Yonkers who appeared to be extremely right wing owning because he seemed to have been scarred by the fact that the left wing is supposedly threatened to blow up the family house, and I guess that can also scar you, I guess, over the years.
Sure.
Well, much of your activity related
to college. Again, it was during the course of the Vietnam War, the anti-war movement, and all of that. I came out sort of more liberal and more progressive, I suppose. And again, when I first started with Judge Collins, he obviously, having been a district attorney under Hogan and under Morgenthau, he was very conservative, and the two of us sort of it was a perfect marriage in that I don't know whether not in terms of opposites attracting, but we both sort of ultimately respected obviously one another, and he used me as a sounding board, I used him as a sounding board, and we sort of met in the middle. Here's a guy that, like I said, was a prosecutor for most of his early career. And by the time he left Supreme Court, he was the judge we help create a mental health court and a drug court where the focus was on treatment rather than punishment. And so he did a you know, he became much more open to all ideas, and I too, I became a little bit more jaded, I have to say, a little, because having seen some of the worst types of cases you might ever want to, you know, set your eyes upon in the Bronx, I became a little less liberal and more, but I haven't lost my the compassion, and I haven't lost the desire to help. It's just I've seen the reality of and the horror of how horrible things can be, and I want to still I do want to maintain and change, obviously, when I can, and deal with those social issues. But it's interesting how the two of us sort of, you know, drifted towards one another, and towards a centrist type of view.
The mentioning that you did about him getting into other areas takes me right into a question that I was about to ask. You're also the co-chair of a committee involved in a diversion project for diagnosing mentally ill substance abusers. What exactly is that, and how does it work?
Well, what it is, you're talking about what you noticed on my resume in terms of the diversion issue?
That's correct.
Yes. Again, when I first started in the Bronx, most drug cases were dealt with just simply, and I had a good friend down there who was in charge of the drug. He was the bureau chief for the district attorney's office in the Bronx, and we used to talk. He would get pleasure, I mean, or at least it was his desire to try to get the most time for every individual that came before him. They'd send them away to jail, and that's he felt he had a good day when he sent individuals away to jail. And over the years, we started to realize that the war on drugs just wasn't working, and we started to get involved with the court and defense attorneys and the collaborative effort and the district attorney's office, and saying, what can we do to change how we're doing things, because what we're doing just simply isn't working. And we started to find that obviously you want to send the dealers away. Those are the people you want to maximize the punishment of. But there were so many people who were just users, who were being used either as mules in terms of carrying the drugs, or who were being coerced into selling drugs just so that they could maintain their habit. And they were hooked, and they really almost didn't have control of what they were doing because of the nature of the addiction. So a thought came, and it was a very good thought, a collaborative thought, that if we can, for at least those people that weren't selling because they were looking to make money, they were selling, or they were either, and they were using, and they were addicted, was if we could get them off the drugs, we could have changed the whole revolving door justice that seemed to be occurring in the Bronx, and we could get them to become productive citizens and productive mothers and fathers, and get them back to being, you know, taking the roles that they needed to take in their families. So we started a system where individuals would, when they say diversion, it would mean rather than just simply have a case dealt with in the normal way with defense attorney, DA, prosecuting, not prosecuting, there would be a collaborative effort to try to see if we could get these people out of the criminal justice system. They would be in the criminal justice system, but out ultimately in this mechanism, they would take a plea
And I went to many federal trainings, which indicated that this was a evidence-based method of solving some of this problem, these problems. These people would take a plea, and it was like what they call a carrot and stick approach.
They would be told that if they entered a year and a half, 90 day, 6 months, depending on what the mental health and the drug professionals determined, they would enter into a program, and if successful, they would then have the charges against them reduced or dismissed. But if they were not successful in the program, they would go away to state prison for anywhere from 1.5 to 3 or 4.5 to 9 years, depending on their level of recidivism, how often they had been arrested prior to the current arrest. And that's how we basically dealt with it. And we had over 75% success rate with these individuals who were in the drug program. They would, again, the carrot and stick approach is so important, because first they needed to know that they had to have a motivation to continue in these long-term programs. And they also some of these people were before a judge now who praised them when they came in, and they were told, you know, you're doing great work. I know how difficult it is to maintain sobriety or to remain clean. And you're doing a great job. You're not only doing a great job for you, but you're doing a great job for your kids or your family or your wife or your parents or whoever loves you. And, you know, when you had the facts in front of you and you would, and for some of these people, it was the first taste of encouragement that they felt in all the years growing up. They were, some of them were from broken homes, so they never had a mother or father really praise them. It was always because of the nature of the community they were growing up in. They were always getting negative reinforcement rather than positive reinforcement. So those courts work very well, and that's what diversion is about. It's trying to get some of these cases that don't need to be in the criminal justice system out of the criminal justice system. So it also then creates more time to deal with the cases that truly need to be before the judges.
Of course, the present Attorney General of the United States said that only bad people have done marijuana. So I thought that's interesting.
Yeah, no, unfortunately, we're in
I hope it's a very short period. I fear we're not. I mean, you're right. I mean, I think that we're heading back towards a time when dealing with non evidence based. I mean, these are climate deniers, climate change deniers. I think these are environment people who are anti. And environment protection. There are all sorts of things that we're currently moving in the wrong direction. We're slipping back on a very slippery slope, and I hope we can regain our footing, because we need to, return to some of the good work that we had accomplished over the last 15 or 20 years.
Do you remember the Peter McWilliams case, by any chance? McWilliams.
If you remind me, I may, but no, I don't, off the top of my
Peter
head,
McWilliams,
I don't remember that.
One of the first technology journalists, and it was at the time that I started writing about technology, so I got to know him very casually through the internet. Politically, he was the libertarian, and he was close. He also did some consulting work for Bill Buckley. He was also homosexual, and he wound up with AIDS. and cancer. And it was during the early time where California had passed the medical marijuana law. He was growing some. They left him alone, but the feds came in. They arrested him, and he wound up in court. And under the terms of his agreement, he was allowed to plead guilty if he did not mention that it was medical marijuana, or what the circumstances were, or that it was approved by the state of California. He was allowed to have probation. He had to agree that he would not use marijuana again, then he'd be tested every week. Well, after a very short time, in reaction to his chemo, and that was his big problem, he threw up, choked on his own vomit, and died.
Oh.
Bill Bailey wrote this scathing column that I might still have someplace, that he just about accused the judge of murder. Said it was the most nonsensical thing he'd ever seen. It was heartless, and it was a very big case then, and I remember it well, and it's interesting that while the present attorney general is saying this, Chris Christie, who's a former prosecutor, he has all these commercials going out about how we want to work with addicts and we want to.
Yes. Well, I'm telling you, so, like I said, my judge was very conservative, but he saw the results, you know, and he, and it's funny because he used to, some of these treatment courts went so far as, they applaud, they had parties upon graduation, and which are all well and good, but my boss who still tried to maintain his conservative demeanor used to say, I don't bake cookies, I don't hug, but I love the success that I'm seeing, you know, that type of thing. So he maintained his decorum, but clearly, I mean, you don't have to be liberal to be enlightened, and obviously I have issues with Chris Christie on a lot of issues. I have, but there are certain things that, you know, conservative, liberal, or whatever, you can see if you can be convinced, as long as you're intelligent and you're smart and you're willing to accept that certain things work. I admire him for doing that, for coming forward and working in that vein. And you know, I think it's really an area of our society where liberals, conservatives, can come together. And I that's one of the things I want to actually put forward in the town of Yorktown, because we are facing a horrible opioid crisis throughout the country, but throughout the state, throughout the county, and in particular throughout our town. And I want to join in partnership with those that are willing to make a difference. And you know that and I'll give credit where credit is due. We have originally you had Senator Murphy and Tommy Diana and Michael Grace creating this heroin task force throughout the state and also within the town. But as much as they've touched on certain areas, it's more needs to be done, and I intend to try to move in that direction. And I intend to try to make it a more global approach rather than the current way they've been dealing with it has been simply with, and I don't mean simply, just when I use the term, they've done good work, but they have been focusing on law enforcement and not as much on prevention and dealing with the underlying causes of a mental illness, self-medication, co-occurring disorders, and all those things that really haven't been encompassed in the fight. And I want to join forces with even more individuals to have a more global approach.
I believe in the town and the immediate area, there has been a big focus through the religious groups. I used to hear various of them talk about what they were doing.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because I just last night I was at paying a Shiva call at a house, and I was speaking with one of the rabbis in town. And when I was involved in the court system dealing with the drug addiction, it was very difficult for me to, some religious groups assisting, but it was difficult to partner with them. We had a problem with the court system did, because of the issue of separation of obviously government and religion, the state. But from a administrative or a now as an executive in the town, I mean, there's still some issues, but I don't have the problem as much as I did working in the court system, trying to get the religious aspect, the religious leaders involved, and that they are a group I want to bring in to the fold, because they do good work. They do make just as we talked a while ago. They make certain facilities available for dealing with recovery. They also the spirituality and the idea of meditation or feeling good about oneself has a very much can be used, I believe, to combat the void that people are trying to fill with these drugs. You know, this void or the unhappiness or the depression. I'm not saying that everyone needs to find God, but it is it can work for some, and for even if it works for just a few, if it can keep them off the drugs, then that's fine. Everyone can find a different means of dealing with the problem, or dealing with the addiction, or dealing with whatever depression, or sometimes it's legal. It's pharmaceuticals, real pharmaceuticals, not obviously the opioids, but there are ways to deal with depression with pharmaceuticals. There are ways to deal with depression through and anxiety through behavioral modifications and how you deal with stress and how, through meditation or calming yourself and there are natural ways of doing it. So we have to figure out all sorts of ways. We live in a very stressful time, a very stressful environment, and I think, unfortunately, people utilize drugs, alcohol, all of that and there's a difference between use and abuse. It's a fine line, and what often happens is there are people with addictive personalities or addictive DNA, and once they get hooked, they need professional help to get off.
We mentioned off and on your role as the town justice. How did you get involved as the town justice, and what were your duties in that role?
I loved working for the town in that capacity. When I did, I was, like I said, I had at that point when I first started having interest in running for town judge, I had already had about 25 years of experience in the court system under my belt. I loved the town. I was raising my family in the town. And I could see, I just felt I had also given a lot of time towards as I had mentioned before, I had been on the conservation board for 12 years. But I felt my real skill set and talent had to do with the law and the courts. And I was trying to think, how could I best give back to the town that I was raising my family in, and how could I best serve the town? And I grew up as a
and I, in my younger days as a Kennedy, a Democrat, you know, and a belief of ask not what your town or country or can do for you, but what you can do for your town or country. And so I was trying to think, how could I best serve the town? And I thought, you know what, there's the position of town judge, and I thought I could really serve the town best in that capacity, give back to the town in that capacity. So circumstances worked in my favor ultimately, and Jeff Cohn, who was the town judge for almost 16, 17 years, ultimately was elevated to the county court, and ultimately now he sits on the appellate division in the state. But at that time, they needed to fill a vacancy. I put my name forward and was very fortunate to have the board appoint me to fill the vacancy for Jeff. And I served that year, and then I ran for election and won a four-year term, and I served that four-year term. And then ultimately, the wave of the electorate, I ran again in 2011 and did not win. There was a Republican sweep in that particular election, just like there was a Democratic sweep in this election. And unfortunately, my term ended. And but while I was the town judge, the town judges or the town court is the closest. Most people think of serving jury duty and this and that, and the closest court to the people of the community is the local town court, and that court deals with vehicle and traffic issues, landlord tenant issues, small claims issues, just disputes amongst the citizens of the town, and it varies. It not only deals with criminal law, it deals with civil law. And so it is probably one of the most, and family law, and it because you draft orders of protection when there are issues between family members. So it's an all-encompassing court. The jurisdiction is limited by the degree, the seriousness in terms of the case. Like, for example, in the criminal side, it's you can do felony arraignments, but the highest case that you can ultimately dispose of is a misdemeanor case. And in the civil side, there are thresholds in terms of monetary value of the kind of cases that you deal with. But other than that, it's probably one of the most diverse courts in all of the state. So you deal with an enormous amount of issues, and it's I found it to be incredibly fulfilling trying to dispense justice in all those different venues.
In addition to your public service work, you also list on your resume the LexisNexis as a four-year employment. My background is in technology. What was your involvement there?
Well, that was I'm not a real a technology maven, but what I did was when I was working for LexisNexis, they had begun publishing, obviously, or with Westlaw and LexisNexis, they basically brought the court's research into the 21st century, and basically. Had all of case law and statutes and everything accessible through computer research and search words, you know, specific word search and things like that. They changed the whole dynamic of legal research. But within that, they still needed editing of and updating of their all their literature to make sure it was current. So what I did is I would get a chapter, let's say, on jury selection in New York State, and I would read and have all that was done, all that had been written by any a particular author on jury selection with footnotes and all that,
But they would, the footnotes would always coincide would be case law citations backing up what the author was describing on how jury selection, all the issues that arise during jury selection. So what I would do is I would research and get the latest changes in the law, and then I would edit the materials to indicate how the law had changed and what the current status of the law was.
I remember writing about this at the time, Westlaw in particular, and it was amazing to me just the idea from my Wall Street background, because I had worked with Morgan Stanley and with Dean Witter, and we had some familiarity with the rent house and our law firms, that you no longer had to go sit in Columbia's law library or work with one of the bigger firms to be able to compete with other bigger firms. It seemed to democratize.
Right. It was all
the
at
whole.
It was so accessible. The knowledge of the law was so accessible now. That's true. As a matter of fact, in the old days, there was a thing called, I don't know if you came across it while you were working there, but it was called the method of testing whether a case was current or not, or still good law. It was called shepherdizing a case, because there was volumes of books called Shepherds, New York Shepherds, and Shepherds simply had, instead of actual case law, it had citations, and then if a case was reversed or if a case was affirmed, there were lists of citations of other cases where it would say affirmed, or reversed, and it was all done by leafing through books, and that's how it was when I first entered, and we're not going back we're going back over 35 years, but it seems like yesterday. But when I was in law school, all of that was done by shepherds. And now you click on a case, and you say you ask the computer to shepherdize, and the computer will tell you immediately whether the case has been affirmed or reversed, or whether it does all that work for you. So it's amazing what has what our technology has brought.
Yeah, it was terrific. Then you also served as the principal of court attorney to Dennis Wong in Queens, and then returned to the Bronx as an attorney referee in Supreme Court. What exactly is an attorney referee?
Attorney referee, I had the distinction of being, most court attorney referees that are utilized in the civil side or in matrimonial cases and things like that. What the attorney referee generally does is they're quasi-judicial appointments. And they basically, the court system is just so full or overrun with litigation that they're utilized by judges. When I told you that my judge utilized me to do his research, what court attorney referees do, they have the power, which has been conferred upon them by the Office of Court Administration and by the courts, to actually do some of the hearings and litigation and actually take testimony. And ultimately what they can do is they'll hear a case, and they do this often in matrimonial cases. They'll hear both sides, they'll take testimony, and they will write a report, or basically a decision, back to the judge that they work for. And the judge will then either will review it and then affirm the decision, that they will actually render a decision or a recommendation to the judge. And the judge will then affirm or basically overrule it and say that he's going to make his own determination. But what it does is it cuts back on the amount of work on each of the judges in the state by utilizing. Now, what happened was with me is I, again, because of my background as being a town judge, and also at the time having helped create the drug courts
in the Bronx. There was a period of time when my judge was sitting in what they call a drug compliance part, and in that part, individuals would come who were in drug treatment programs. Reports would be issued to the judge, and the judge would determine whether to continue the person in the program, violate the person for failing to comply, and then send that person to jail, or ultimately, if the person was a success, release the individual and accept the disposition. My boss had so many responsibilities. He suggested to the court administration that with my background and with my expertise in the field, that he asked if I would be permitted to act as a court attorney referee in the criminal division. And again, I served with the distinction of being the only court attorney referee in all of the state on the criminal side. And wow. I did that for about a year. And ultimately, it was a very successful program. Obviously, as a court attorney referee, I couldn't sentence anyone to jail. Everything was done was through a report back to my judge. I would report back to him what the status of the particular case was. He would then relay back through me what the court action was to be. And then I would relay that back to the lawyers and to the defendant, to the district attorney's office. And I would actually sit in court, and there would be, I would basically be sitting again as a quasi-judge reporting back to my judge.
Then in 2017, you ran for town supervisor. What brought on the decision to do so?
Well, I originally ran, if you recall, I don't know if you recall, I ran 2 years before for council. Because I was unhappy with the direction the town was moving, and I ran. I put myself out there. I ended up losing by 8 votes 2 years ago, and again I sat back and watched the town continue in the manner and the. I didn't like the discourse I was hearing at town board meetings. I didn't like. Some of the things that the town board were doing. So I was sort of determined to run again. At least my original thought was to run in the capacity again as town council, as I had just lost, so, you know, by such a slim margin. And that was my original intent back last March. But Alice Roker had been the town clerk for 25 years, and we knew we had an incumbent in Vishnu Patel, who was going to run again for the council. So there was going to be one council seat available and the town supervisor position. And Alice had approached me and talked to me and said that she was also very unhappy, even having stepped back out of the town government for 2 years. But she was so unhappy, she thought that she wanted to get back involved. And originally, I thought that she might have had desires to run for supervisor, which would have been fine for me, and I would have run for council again. And but then we talked some more, and she said, you know, Lanny, I retired from the town clerk because I didn't want to be full-time anymore. And my thought was, you know, Alice, we're a stronger team together than we are apart, and I'd be willing to refocus, and I believe I have the skill set and the background and the ability to serve as supervisor. And if that's what we need to do to get you back involved, then I think that would be best for the town. And so that was a decision sort of made between the two of us, along with the regular party. And again, not just obviously we needed the district leaders to agree as well. It wasn't something that we didn't just simply say, this is how it's going to be. This idea was brought before the Democratic committee, and we overwhelmingly were voted in to be the candidates for the Democratic Party.
In the election, you've defeated the three-term incumbent, Michael Grace. What were the defining issues of the election, as you see it?
I think part of it was the, to simplify, part of it was we only had 7,000 people come out 2 years before when I lost by 8 votes. We were convinced that we needed to bring out there more of the electorate for it to be a more of a statement, and we felt that we had a better chance if the electorate came out to vote. And with that said, this time, and I think a good portion of it was either anti-Trump or pro-Trump, but for some reason he has spurred people to come out to vote. There was a feeling, I think, of apathy that was hit in a major way with his election. And this year we had, instead of 7,000 people come out to vote, we had a record number of 12,000 come out to vote. And I think that was a huge, huge change in the attitude of the electorate. And I think that was a major factor. I think another factor was, I mean, we ran on a a platform of open government. I'm not going to say anything really negative about Michael. I think he truly believed he was doing and so was serving the town in the best way he knew possible. But I believe that his philosophy on leadership is different than mine, in that he really believed that you needed and I believe you need a strong leader in the town, but he believed you needed a leader that would take a vision and run with it, whether or not it was necessarily the popular. And I don't mean to be, when I say popular, I don't mean only go with what people, you try to satisfy everybody's needs, because you can't make everyone happy. But I think he believed, like, for example, he believed, one of the ideas was he had an idea to move the highway garage, because he believed that was the best thing to do, to take a facility in the town and that isn't income producing, because it's a town facility, to develop it, to sell it, and to move that facility elsewhere with monies that you made by the sale. And I've looked at the same project, and while I intend to give every project its fair review, my initial feeling, at least after having spoken with the highway garage superintendent, that Michael's vision was ultimately to replace the highway garage that we have with what he would have in his pocket would ultimately be about $4 million to build a new facility. And I have been told by the highway superintendent that in order to build the facility that we have currently, even though it may be slightly run down, obviously could use some facelifts, but the actual structure and what it gives to them, it would cost at least $8 million to build that kind of facility in another location. And so I just don't see, at least currently, I need to speak to more people and to find out what additional funding may be available. But those are the kind of things. And we had thousands and thousands of people sign petition to at least, well, when I say thousands, I think we had about 2,600, over 2,000 people sign a petition saying they didn't want the highway garage moved. Basically it was that those people were not being listened to. And the Democratic Party basically, the candidates indicated, we want to hear what the people have to say. And another example of a feeling that I think people were starting to feel that their voices weren't being heard, the current administration, or the prior administration, I should say, over the last 6 years, changed the way meetings were held. They moved courtesy of the floor from the beginning to the end of meetings, so that it was very difficult or inconvenient. They made it inconvenient for people to get have their voices heard. They would have to come and stay till maybe 10:30 at night sometimes before they could even think to voice their opinions on issues of the day. One of the first actions I took when I came in was to move courtesy of the floor back to the beginning of the meetings where they had been in the past, so that people could voice. And so it's more of just a philosophy, or I think there's just a different feel in the town right now, that it's a more inclusive and responsive government. I hope that's the case. That's what I intend to bring to with my administration.
You mentioned the parties and the anti-Trump and the Democrats and the Republicans. I've wondered for a long time how much role the parties they really play in local elections. I remember that Susan Siegel served as a Republican elected town supervisor before losing the primary to Mike Grace and became a Democrat, while the present town highway commissioner, Dave Paganelli, after losing the bid as a Democrat to be the town councilman, won a subsequent election as a Republican. It would seem to me that if the parties have strong philosophical platforms, that when you look at people bouncing back and forth because they lose an election as a Yankee, then become a Met.
Right. I think we're a strange town in that regard, I believe. I've always been a Democrat. I've been a Democrat. Like I said, I'm a Kennedy Democrat. I was when I first registered back when I was 18 years old. I'm now 61. I've never changed the party affiliation. But I have haven't always agreed with, I've lived through the Obama administration. I've lived through a lot of the Clinton administration. I've lived through Reagan and Nixon and I can't say that I've always been staunchly supportive of everything Democrats have always done. And I can't say I've always been opposed to some of the things I've seen some Republicans do. So I am truly a more of a moderate and I believe a centrist, but I do have leanings. I do believe government is important. I guess that's the big difference. I believe government isn't, as Reagan once said, government isn't the solution. Actually, the government is the problem. I'm sort of misquoting it, but that's the basic gist of what he said. And I truly believe that government is sometimes needed to solve or help solve some of the nation's ailings. And I'm not, on the other hand, I don't believe that government is the cure-all, we do need citizens to step forward and to actually, fight for what's right. With that said, in Yorktown, which is it's a little unique because, like you say, we have had so many people jump from party to party. Linda Cooper, I believe, at one time was a Democrat, then became a Republican. Don Peters was a Republican, one is a Democrat, like you said. As you know, those are examples. So I think our town, while there is strong, I've knocked on doors and people have looked at me and said, and it's bothered me both ways. I've had gone to Republican doors and people have said to me, what party are you in? And I say, I'm a Democrat. And they just simply say, sorry, wrong party. And I've also gone to doors where I've gone to Democratic doors and they've said, are you a Democrat? And I'd say, yes. And they'd say, well, you got my vote. And at both of those doors, I felt compelled. I haven't always done it. To say, don't you want to know what I do, what I stand for, who I am, before you start to get, even with the people that want to give me their support. But I do believe that there is a significant population or part of our citizenry that vote for the person. I'm encouraged by that because I think if you can convey your message, ultimately, I think it can be successful. And I'll give you something that was very encouraging to me. And this, I think this flies in the face of politics. This was a horrible election, I have to say. I was very upset with the tone of the election. But with all of that said, our town tends to be a more conservative town. It went for Trump 2 years ago, not by a large margin, but it went for Trump. But I think an interesting statement made by the electorate in this particular election is George Latimer won the county for county executive. He lost Yorktown, yet the remainder of the Democratic slate won. So that means that people voted for those that wanted to vote for Astorino, voted for Astorino on the Republican line and had to leave that line. A majority of them had to leave that line and vote for me, Alice Roker, and Vishnu Patel. So there was actually, it wasn't straight politics one way or the other. And I find that encouraging. I find that as a breath of fresh air. And I hope it continues that people look at the issues, look at the people, look at the motivation for running, and ultimately make the determination based upon that.
On a related topic, and it ties right into that, one of the main points of your swearing-in speech, and it even led me to think about it and to write a poem about it, was your desire to keep personal heat out of policy debates and to avoid the invective that we see daily at the national level. Do you think you'll be able to do this?
I think we can do it locally. I think there's still resistance. I believe that this town has been partisan in one manner or another for the last 6 to 8 years in one direction, and I've told this to many people. It's my intent to call most of the shots right down the middle and do what's best, and there should be no Republican way of doing it or a Democratic way of doing it. Kennedy said that there should just be the right way of doing it, the correct way of doing it. And with that said, unfortunately, to some degree, to make like some of the committees, for example, or some of the volunteer boards more fair and more centrist, I may have to be a little top heavy in appointing one direction or another, almost like a pendulum swinging back and forth until you ultimately land in the middle. And I intend to I don't intend to look at politics, but you can't completely take it unfortunately. Ultimately, I hope to remove it completely, but it's been so ingrained, I believe, in our town for the last number of years that I want to try to remove it. It's going to take an effort. It's not going to happen just by wishing it to happen.
You already mentioned one contentious issue with the highway garage. The other one I'm aware of is the so-called ring road around the Jefferson Valley Mall. Could you frame that for us? Have you reached any decision on it?
No, I haven't reached a decision. I've spoken to many people. I actually was at a local town training for newly elected officials up in Albany, and they had some experts up there from Cornell. Cornell has basically is the is a focal point for highway and roads research for the state, and I spoke to a number of people up there. There are a lot of issues. It's not an easy decision. Obviously, we want them all to be successful, but there's a lot of issues. One of which is I'll throw out there is maintenance, liability to the town, Another is setting a precedent. If we do it for, if the town does it for one business, how is that going to, how are other businesses going to feel? Are they going to approach the town now and say, well, we want you to do a cut-in off one of the roads and take over liability for us as well? And it's a dangerous precedent to set, and it's I'm not so sure. And it happens to be an issue that cannot solely be determined by the town board. First of all, we have obviously five different. I'm just one vote. And we have five different votes on the town board, and I respect everyone on that board to do what they believe, or at least vote in their conscience what they believe is the right thing to do in the best interest of the town. But we also have a highway superintendent, and a road cannot be taken by the town without sign-on by the highway superintendent, and I know he has issues as well. So this is not something that's going to be an easy determination, and it's going. But it will take a collaborative effort, and ultimately just a vote to determine whether or not people believe it's the right thing for the town.
You've talked about your public service. I also have an active daughter in public service, and I heard it. At one meeting after you left, the preceding town supervisor speak well of her. Could you tell us what she's been doing?
Well, I try to keep my family issues outside of politics, and as best I can for obviously many reasons. But I happen to be very proud. My daughter has gotten involved in a support group called Siblings for Siblings, and she works with the Alliance for Safe Kids and with some of the support groups in the town and the volunteer groups in the town. And I'm very proud of the fact that she has motivation to do to work for the town, and she has the motivation to help people. And I'm very proud of her in that regard.
That's terrific. Carry on the tradition, too. We've covered
right.
A lot of bases in exploring your very interesting and productive life. What else might you like the audience to know about either or both Yorktown Supervisor Elon D. Gilbert or plain citizen Lana Gilbert?
Well, that's a good question. I think I've covered a good portion of it in this interview. But I hope the best job I possibly can over the next 2 years, and do what I believe is, safe. Do what I can to make Yorktown a better place than it already is. It's a wonderful town. It was a place where I chose to move my family and raise my family, and in the most part, I've found gained some incredible relationships with people and with and gotten enormous amount of support. I believe that, I want people to believe and truly believe, because it's real, that my motivation is to serve the town, and it ends there in terms of motivation. There's no other underlying desire that I have. I want to leave having made the town at least served and made the town a better place than before I got here. And if I can do that, I feel I've left an imprint. I don't have to leave a legacy. That was sort of something that was said by my predecessor, and I don't have a problem with some people wanting to leave legacies, but that's not my desire. I don't want to leave a legacy. I just want to leave the place that I lived and worked and loved in a better place than it was than when I found it. And that's sort of my message.
But that's a terrific message. Thank you very much, Lonnie. It's been a real pleasure.
Okay, and it's been a pleasure talking to you tonight, and I hope to see you again at the next board meeting and thereafter. Okay.
And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in a book. Go to my website for the URLs of previous shows.
And wait till next year.
and join us next week for Yorktown poet Terry Dugan. Until when, as he used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya, and we'll ask Count Basie to take us off.